hesitated, holding up a hand to the waiter. She ordered a martini. Lots of ice. A recreational drink, he thought. She wasn't out to hide anything, to lose herself in alcohol. He was a little disappointed.
"If it makes you feel any better," he said, lightly, "I don't know how to do anything but work."
"Oh, I think you do," she responded. "Men find it easier to work than to deal with anything else."
"Anything else?"
"The messiness of everyday life. People not behaving as you'd like, and feeling things you'd rather they didn't feel. At work, you can achieve results, be the master of your domain. People do as you say."
"Not in my world," he laughed.
"But you can write a story and see it on the newsstands the next day, just as you wrote it. Doesn't that make you feel rather proud?"
"It used to. That wears off after a while. I don't think I've done much I can feel proud of for some time. Everything I write is ephemeral. Tomorrow's fish and chip paper."
"No? Then why work so hard?" He swallowed, pushing an image of his son from him. Suddenly he wanted a drink very much. He forced a smile.
"All the reasons you say. So much easier than dealing with everything else."
Their eyes met, and in that unguarded moment, her smile fell away. She flushed a little and stirred her drink, slowly, with a cocktail stick. "Vicariously," she said slowly. "You'll have to tell me what that means, Anthony." The way she said his name induced a kind of intimacy. It promised something, a repetition in some future time.
"It means," Anthony's mouth had dried, "it means pleasure gained through the pleasure of someone else."
After she had dropped him at his hotel, he lay on the bed and stared at the ceiling for almost an hour. Then he went down to reception, asked for a postcard, and wrote a note to his son, wondering if Clarissa would bother to pass it on. When he returned to his room, a note had been pushed under the door. "Dear Boot, while I'm not yet convinced you're not an ass, I'm willing to give you another chance to convince me. My dinner plans have fallen through for this evening. I'll be dining in the Hotel de Calypso on Rue Saint-Jacques and would welcome company. 8 p.m. He read this twice, then ran downstairs and sent a telegram to Don. "Ignore last telegram. Stop. I'm staying on to work on series about Riviera High Society. Stop. Will include fashion tips. Stop." He grinned, folded it, and handed it over, picturing his editor's face when he read it. Then tried to work out how to get his suit laundered before the evening. That night, Anthony O'Hare was utterly charming. He was the person he should have been the previous evening. He was the person he perhaps should have been when he was married. He was witty, courteous, chivalrous. She had never been to Congo. Her husband said it was not for your sort. And perhaps because he now had some inbuilt need to contradict Sterling, Anthony determined to make her want to love it. He talked to her of the elegant tree-lined streets of Leopoldville, of the Belgian settlers who imported all their food, tinned and frozen, at hideous expense, rather than eat in one of the world's most glorious cornucopias of produce. He told her of the shock of the city's Europeans, when an uprising at the Leopoldville garrison ended with their pursuit and flight to the relative safety of Stanleyville. He wanted her to see him at his best, to look at him with admiration, instead of that air of pity and irritation. And something strange happened. As he acted the charming, upbeat stranger, he found that he briefly became him. He thought of his mother. "Smile," she would tell him when he was a boy. It would make him happier. He hadn't believed her. Jennifer, in turn, was light-hearted. She listened more than she talked, as socially clever women were wont to do. And when she laughed at something he said, he found himself expanding, keen to make her do it again. He realized, with gratification, that they drew admiring glances from those around them. That terribly gay couple at table 16. She was curiously unabashed at being seen with a man who was not her husband. Perhaps this was how Riviera society functioned, he thought. An endless social duet with other people's husbands and wives. He didn't like to think of the other possibility, that a man of his stature, his class, could not be seen as a threat. Shortly after the main course, a tall man in an immaculately cut suit appeared at their table. He kissed Jennifer on both cheeks, then waited, after they had exchanged pleasantries, to be introduced. "Richard, darling, this is Mr. Boot," she said, straight-faced. "He's been working on a profile of Larry for the newspapers back in England. I'm filling in the detail, and trying to show him that industrialists and their wives are not entirely dull."
"I don't think anyone could accuse you of being dull, Jenny."
He held out his hand for Anthony to shake it.
"Richard Case." "Anthony, Boot. There's nothing dull about Riviera society as far as I can see. Mr. and Mrs. Sterling have been wonderful hosts," he said.
He was determined to be diplomatic. "Perhaps Mr. Boot will write something about you, too. Richard owns the hotel at the top of the hill, the one with the fabulous views. He's at the absolute epicenter of Riviera society."
"Perhaps we can accommodate you on your next visit, Mr. Boot," the man said. "I should like that very much, but I'll wait and see if Mr. Sterling enjoys what I've written before I predict whether I'll be allowed back," he said.
They had both been so careful to mention Lawrence repeatedly, he thought afterwards, to keep him invisibly between them. That evening, she glowed. She gave off a vibration of energy that he suspected only he could detect.
"Do I do this to you?" he wondered as he watched her eat. "Or is it just the relief of being out from under the forbidding eye of that husband of yours?"
Remembering how Sterling had humiliated her the previous evening, he asked her opinion on the markets, Mr. Macmillan, the royal wedding, refusing to let her defer to his own judgment. She was not greatly aware of the world beyond hers, but was astute on human nature, and interested enough in what he had to say to be flattering company. He thought briefly of Clarissa, of her sour pronouncements on the people around her, her readiness to see slights in the most cursory gestures. He had not enjoyed an evening so much for years. "I should be going soon," she said, after a glance at her watch. The coffee had arrived, accompanied by a small silver plate of perfectly arranged petit four. He laid his napkin on the table, feeling the drag of disappointment.
"You can't," he said, and added hurriedly, "I'm still not sure if I've overridden your previous opinion of me."
"Really? Oh, I suppose there is that." She turned her head, saw Richard Case at the bar with friends. He looked away swiftly as if he had been watching them. She studied Anthony's face. If she had been testing him, he appeared to have passed. She leant forward and lowered her voice. "Can you row?"
"Can I row?"
They walked down to the quay. There she peered down at the water, as if she wasn't confident of recognizing the boat without double-checking its name, and finally pointed him towards a small dinghy. He climbed down into it, then gave her his hand so that she could take the seat opposite him. The breeze was warm, the lights of the lobster boats winking peaceably in the inky darkness.
"Where are we headed?"
He removed his jacket, laid it on the seat beside him, and picked up the oars. "Oh, just row that way. I'll show you when we're there." He pulled slowly, listening to the slap of the waves against the sides of the little boat. She sat opposite, her wrap loose around her shoulders. She was twisted away from him, the better to watch where she was guiding him. Anthony's thoughts had stalled. In normal circumstances, he would have been thinking strategically, working out when he would make his move, excited at the prospect of the night ahead. But even though he was alone with this woman, even though she had invited him onto a boat in the middle of a black sea, he wasn't convinced he knew which way this evening would go. "There," she said, pointing. "It's that one."
"A boat, you said?"
He stared at the vast, sleek, white yacht. "A biggish boat," she conceded. "I'm not really a yacht person. I only pop aboard a couple of times a year." They secured the dinghy and climbed aboard the yacht. She told him to sit on the cushioned bench, and a few minutes later emerged from the cabin. She had shed her shoes, he noted, trying not to stare at her impossibly small feet. "I've made you an alcohol-free cocktail," she said, holding it towards him. "I wasn't sure you could face more tonic water." It was warm, even so far out in the harbour, and the waves were so gentle that the yacht barely moved beneath them. Behind her, he could see the lights of the harbour, the occasional car making its way up the coast road. He thought of Congo, and felt like someone airlifted out of hell to a heaven he might only have imagined. She had poured herself another martini, and tucked her feet neatly under her on the bench opposite.
"So," he said, "how did you and your husband meet?"
"My husband? Are we still working?"
"No, I'm intrigued."
"By what?"
"By how he..." He checked himself. "I'm interested in how people end up together."
"We met at a ball. He was donating money to wounded servicemen. He was seated at my table, asked me out to dinner, and that was it."
"That was it?"
"It was very straightforward. After a few months, he asked me to marry him, and I agreed."
"You were very young."
"I was 22. My parents were delighted."
"Because he's rich?"
"Because they thought he was a suitable match. He was a solid sort, and he had a good reputation."
"And those things are important to you?"
"Aren't they important to everyone?" She fiddled with the hem of her skirt, straightening and smoothing it. "Now I ask the questions. How long were you married for, Boot?"
3 years.
"Not very long."
"I knew pretty quickly that we'd made a mistake."
"And she didn't mind you divorcing her?"
"She divorced me."
She eyed him, and he could see her assessing all the ways in which he might have deserved it.
"I wasn't a faithful husband," he added, not sure, as he spoke, why he should tell her this.
"You must miss your son."
"Yes," he said. "I sometimes wonder whether I'd have done what I did if I'd known how much."
"Is that why you drink?"
He raised a wry smile. "Don't try to fix me, Mrs. Sterling. I've been the hobby of far too many well-meaning women."
She looked down at her drink. "Who said I wanted to fix you?"
"You have that charitable air about you. It makes me nervous."
"You can't hide sadness."
"And you would know."
"I'm not a fool. Nobody gets everything. I know that as well as you do."
"Your husband did."
"It's nice of you to say so."
"I'm not saying it nicely."
Their eyes locked, and then she looked away towards the shore. The mood had become almost combative, as if they were quietly furious with each other. Away from the constraints of real life on the shore, something had loosened between them.
"I want her," he thought,
and was almost reassured that he could feel something so ordinary. "How many married women have you slept with?" Her voice cut through the still air. He almost choked on his drink.
"It's probably simpler to say that I've slept with few who weren't married."
She pondered this. "Are we a safer bet?"
"Yes."
"And why do these women sleep with you?"
"I don't know. Perhaps because they're unhappy."
"And you make them happy?"
"For a little while, I suppose."
"Doesn't that make you a gigolo?" That smile again, playing at the corners of her mouth.
"No, just someone who likes to make love to married women."
This time the silence seemed to enter his bones. He would have broken it if he'd had the slightest idea what to say. "I'm not going to make love to you, Mr. O'Hare." He played the words over twice in his head before he could be sure of what she'd said. He took another sip of his drink, recovering.
"That's fine."
"Really?"
"No." He forced a smile. "It's not, but it'll have to be."
"I'm not unhappy enough to sleep with you."
God, when she looked at him, it was as if she could see everything. He wasn't sure he liked it.
"I've never even kissed another man since I got married. Not one."
"That's admirable."
"You don't believe it?"
"Yes, I do. It's rare."
Now you do think I'm terribly dull. She stood up and walked around the edge of the yacht, turning towards him when she got to the bridge. Do your married women fall in love with you?
A little.
Are they sad when you leave them?
How do you know they don't leave me?
She waited.
As to whether they fall in love,
he added eventually, I don't generally speak to them afterwards. You ignore them?
No, I'm often abroad. I tend not to spend much time in one place. And besides, they have their husbands, their lives. I don't believe any of them ever intended to leave their husbands. I was just a diversion.
Did you love any of them?
No.
Did you love your wife?
I thought so. Now I'm not sure.
Have you ever loved anyone?
My son.
How old is he?
8. You'd make a good journalist.
You really can't bear it that I do nothing useful, can you?
She burst out laughing. I think you may be wasted in the life you're in.
Is that so? And what would you have me do instead? She came a few steps closer to him. He could see the moon reflecting light on her pale skin, the blue shadow in the hollow of her neck. She took another step, and her voice lowered, even though nobody was near. What was it you said to me, Anthony? Don't try to fix me.
Why should I? You've told me you're not unhappy.
His breath had caught at the back of his throat. She was so close now, her eyes searching his. He felt drunk, his senses sharpened, as if every part of her was ruthlessly imprinting itself on his consciousness. He breathed in her scent, something floral, oriental. I think, she said slowly, that everything you have said to me tonight is what you would say to any of your married women.
You're wrong, he said.
But he knew she was entirely correct. It was all he could do not to crush that mouth, bury it under his own. He didn't think he had ever been more aroused in his life. I think, she said, that you and I could make each other terribly unhappy. And as she spoke, something deep inside him keeled over a little as if in defeat.
I think, he said slowly, that I'd like that very much.
Staying in Greece, not coming back to London, because you scare me, but in a good way. Male to female, via postcard. Chapter 6. The women were tapping again. She could just see them from her bedroom window. One dark, one with unfeasibly red hair, seated at the window of the first floor flat on the corner. When any man walked past, they would tap at the glass, waving and smiling, if he was unwise enough to look up. They infuriated Lawrence. There had been a high court case earlier that year, in which the judge had warned such women against doing this. Lawrence said that their soliciting, low-key as it might be, was lowering the tone of the area. He couldn't understand why, if they were breaking the law, no one did a damn thing about it. Jennifer didn't mind them. To her, they seemed imprisoned behind the glass. Once, she'd even waved to them, but they had stared blankly at her, and she had hurried on. That aside, her days had fallen into a new routine. She would rise when Lawrence did, make him coffee and toast, and fetch the newspaper from the hallway while he shaved and dressed. Often she was up before him, fixing her hair and makeup so that while she moved around the kitchen in her dressing gown, she appeared pleasing and put together for those few occasions when he looked up from his newspaper. It was somehow easier to start the day without him sighing in irritation. He would leave the table, allow her to help him with his overcoat, and usually, sometime after 8, his driver would knock discreetly at the front door. She would wave until the car disappeared around the corner. Some 10 minutes later, she would greet Mrs. Cordoza, and as the older woman made them a pot of tea, perhaps remarking on the cold, she would run through the list of things she had prepared that detailed what might need doing that day. On top of the usual tasks,
The vacuuming, dusting and washing. There was often a little sewing. A button might have fallen off Lawrence's shirt cuff, or some shoes needed cleaning. Mrs. Cardozo might be required to sort through the linen cupboard, checking and refolding what was within, or to polish the canteen of silver sitting at the kitchen table, which would be spread with newspaper while she completed the task listening to the wireless. Jennifer, meanwhile, would bathe and dress. She might pop next door for coffee with Yvonne, take her mother for a light lunch, or hail a taxi and go into the centre of town to do a little Christmas shopping. She made sure she had always returned by early afternoon. It was at that point that she usually found some other task for Mrs. Cardozo, a bus trip to buy curtain material, a search for a particular type of fish that Lawrence had said he might like. Once, she gave the housekeeper an afternoon off, anything to grant herself an hour or two alone in the house, buy time to search for more letters. In the 2 weeks that had passed since she'd discovered the first, she had found two more. It, too, was addressed to a P.O. box, but was clearly for her. The same handwriting, the same passionate, direct way of speaking. The words seemed to echo some sound deep within. They described events that, while she couldn't remember them, held a deep resonance, like the vibrations of a huge bell long after it had stopped ringing. None were signed other than with B. She had read them, and read them again, until the words were imprinted on her soul. Dearest girl, it's 4 a.m. I can't sleep, knowing he is returning to you tonight. It is the road to madness, but I lie here imagining him lying next to you, his license to touch you, to hold you, and I would do anything to make that freedom mine. You were so angry with me when you found me drinking at Alberto's. You called it an indulgence, and I'm afraid my response was unforgivable. Men hurt themselves when they lash out, and as cruel and stupid as my words may have been, I think you know your words hurt me more. Felipe told me I was a fool when you left, and he was right. I'm telling you this because I need you to know that I'm going to be a better man. Ha! I can barely believe I'm writing such a cliché, but it's true. You make me want to be a better version of myself. I've sat here for hours, staring at the whiskey bottle, and then, not 5 minutes ago, I finally got up and poured the whole darned lot into the sink. I will be a better person for you, darling. I want to live well. Wish for you to be proud of me. If all we're allowed is hours, minutes, I want to be able to etch each of them onto my memory with exquisite clarity, so that I can recall them at moments like this, when my very soul feels blackened. Take him to you if you must, my love, but don't love him. Please, don't love him. Yours selfishly, B. Her eyes had welled with tears at these last lines. Don't love him. Please don't love him. Everything had become a little clearer to her now. She had not imagined the distance she felt between herself and Lawrence. It was the result of her having fallen in love with someone else. These were passionate letters. This man had opened himself to her in a way that Lawrence never could. When she read his notes, her skin prickled, her heart raced. She recognized these words. But for all that she knew them, there was still a great hole at their heart. Her mind buzzed with questions. Had the affair been going on for long? Was it recent? Had she slept with this man? Is that why things felt so physically stilted with her husband? And, most incomprehensible of all, who was this lover? She'd gone over the three letters forensically, searching for clues. She could think of no one she knew whose name began with B, say Bill, or her husband's accountant, whose name was Bernard. She knew without a shadow of doubt that she had never been in love with him. Had B seen her at the hospital, in the days when her mind had not been her own, when everyone had been indistinct around her? Was he watching at a distance now, waiting for her to get in touch? He existed somewhere. He held the key to everything. Day after day, she tried to imagine her way back into her former self, this woman of secrets. Where would the Jennifer of old have hidden letters? Where were the clues to her other secret existence? Two of the letters she had uncovered in books, another folded neatly in a balled-up stocking. All were in places her husband would never have thought of looking. I was clever, she thought, and then a little more uncomfortably, I was duplicitous. Mother, she said one lunchtime over a sandwich on the top floor of John Lewis, who was driving when I had my accident? Her mother had glanced up sharply. The restaurant around them was packed with customers, laden with shopping bags and heavy coats, the dining room thick with chatter and the clatter of crockery. She glanced around before she turned back to Jennifer, as if the question was almost subversive. Darling, do we really need to revisit that? Jennifer sipped her tea. I know so little about what happened. It might help if I could put the pieces together. You nearly died. I really don't want to think about it. But what happened? Was I driving? Her mother inspected her plate. I don't recall. And if it wasn't me, what happened to the driver? If I was hurt, he must have been too. I don't know. How would I? Lawrence always looks after his staff, doesn't he? I assume he wasn't badly hurt. If he needed treatment, I dare say Lawrence would have paid for it. Jennifer thought of the driver who had picked them up when she left hospital. A tired-looking man in his 60s, with a neat moustache and a balding head. He had not looked as if he had suffered any great trauma, or as if he might have been her lover. Her mother pushed away the remains of her sandwich. Why don't you ask him? I will. But she knew she wouldn't. He doesn't want me to dwell on things. Well, I'm sure he's quite right, darling. Perhaps you should heed his advice. Do you know where I was going? The older woman was flustered now, a little exasperated by this line of questioning. I've no idea. Shopping, probably. Look, it happened somewhere near Marylebone Road. I believe you hit a bus. Or a bus hit you. It was all so awful, Jenny, darling. We could only think about you getting better. Her mouth closed in a thin line, which told Jennifer that the conversation was at an end. In the corner of the canteen, a woman wrapped in a dark green coat was gazing into the eyes of a man who traced her profile with a finger. As Jennifer watched, she took his fingertip between her teeth. The casual intimacy of the gesture sent a little electric shock through her. No one else seemed to have noticed the pair. Mrs. Verinder wiped her mouth with her napkin. What does it really matter, dear? Car accidents happen. The more cars there are, the more dangerous it seems to be. I don't think half of the people on the roads can drive. Not like your father could. Now, he was a careful driver. Jennifer wasn't listening. Anyway, you're all fixed up now, aren't you? All better. I'm fine. Jennifer turned a bright smile on her mother. Just fine. When she and Lawrence went out in the evenings now, to dinner or for drinks, she found herself looking at their wider circle of friends and acquaintances with new eyes. When a man's focus lingered on her a little longer than it should have, she found herself unable to tear her gaze away. Was it him? Was there some meaning behind his pleasant greeting? Was that a knowing smile? There were three possible men. If B was in fact a nickname, there was Jack Amory, the head of a motor spares company who was unmarried and kissed her hand ostentatiously whenever they met. But he did it almost with a wink to Lawrence, and she couldn't work out if this was a double bluff. There was Reggie Carpenter, Yvonne's cousin, who sometimes made up the numbers at dinner. Dark-haired with tired, humorous eyes, he was younger than she imagined her letter writer to be. But he was charming and funny,
and seemed always to ensure that he was sitting at her side when Lawrence wasn't there. And then there was Bill, of course. Bill, who told jokes as if they were only for her approval, who laughingly declared he adored her, even in front of Violet. He definitely had feelings for her, but could she have had feelings for him? She began to pay more attention to her appearance. She made regular visits to the hairdresser, bought some new dresses, became chattier, more your old self, as Yvonne said approvingly. In the weeks after the accident, she had hidden behind her girlfriends, but now she asked questions, quizzed them politely, but with some determination, seeking the chink in the armour that might lead to some answers. Occasionally, she dropped clues into conversations, inquiring whether anyone might like a whiskey, then scanning the men's faces for a spark of recognition. But Lawrence was never far away, and she suspected that even if they had picked up on her clues, they could have conveyed little to her in response. If her husband noticed a particular intensity in her conversations with their friends, he didn't remark on it. He didn't remark on March. He hadn't approached her once, physically, since the night they had argued. He was polite, but distant. He worked late in his study, and was often up and out before she awoke. Several times she passed the spare room and saw the ruffled bedspread that told her he had spent another night alone. A silent rebuke. She knew she should feel worse about it than she did, but increasingly, she wanted the freedom to retreat into her private, parallel world, where she could retrace her mythical, passionate romance, see herself through the eyes of the man who adored her. Somewhere, she told herself, B was still out there, waiting. These are to sign, and on the filing cabinet there are several gifts that arrived this morning. There's a case of champagne from Citroën, a hamper from the cement people in Peterborough, and a box of chocolates from your accountants. I know you don't like soft centres, so I was wondering if you'd like me to hand them round the office. I know Elsie Machinsky is particularly partial to fondants. He barely looked up.
That'll be fine.
Moira observed that Mr. Sterling's thoughts were far from Christmas gifts. And I hope you don't mind, but I've gone ahead and organised the bits and pieces for the Christmas party. You decided it would be better held here than in a restaurant, now the company is so much larger. So I've asked caterers to lay on a small buffet.
Good. When is it?
The 23rd, after we finish for the day. That's the Friday before we break up.
Yes.
Why should he seem so preoccupied, so miserable? Business had never been better. Their products were in demand. Even with the credit squeeze predicted by the newspapers, Acme Mineral and Mining had one of the healthiest balance sheets in the country. There had been no more of the troublemaking letters, and those she had received the previous month still lingered, unseen by her boss, in her top drawer. I also thought she might like to... He glanced up suddenly at a sound outside, and Moira turned, startled, to see what he was looking at. There she was, walking through the office, her hair set in immaculate waves, a little red pillbox hat perched on her head, the exact shade of her shoes. What was she doing here? Mrs. Sterling gazed around her as if she was looking for someone, and then Mr. Stevens, from accounts, walked up to her, holding out his hand. She took it, and they chatted briefly before they looked across the office, towards where she and Mr. Sterling were standing. Mrs. Sterling raised a hand in greeting. Moira was reaching for her hair. Some women managed always to look as if they had stepped out of the pages of a fashion magazine, and Jennifer Sterling was one of them. Moira didn't mind. She had always preferred to focus her energies on work, on more substantial achievements. But it was hard when the woman walked into the office, her skin glowing from the cold outside, two fiery diamond studs glinting in her ears, not to feel the tiniest bit dull in comparison. She was like a perfectly wrapped Christmas parcel, a glittering bauble. Mrs. Sterling, Moira said politely. Hello, she said.
This is an unexpected pleasure.
Mr. Sterling stood to greet her, rather awkward, but perhaps secretly pleased, like an unloved student who had been approached by the school sweetheart.
Would you like me to leave?
Moira felt awkward standing between them.
I've got some filing I could be...
Oh, no, not on my account. I'll only be a minute. She turned back to her husband.
I was passing, and I thought I'd check whether you were likely to be late this evening. If you are, I might pop over to the Harrisons. They're doing mulled wine.
Yes, you do that. I can meet you there if I finish early.
That would be nice, she said. She gave off a faint sense of Nina Ricci. Moira had tried it the previous week in D.H. Evans, but had thought it a little pricey. Now she regretted not having bought it.
I'll try not to be too late.
Mrs. Sterling didn't seem in any hurry to leave. She stood in front of her husband, but she seemed more interested in looking at the office, the men at their desks. She surveyed it all with some concentration. It was as if she had never seen the place before.
"It's been a while since you were here," he said.
"Yes," she said. "I suppose it has." There was a short silence. "Oh," she said abruptly, "what are your drivers' names?" He frowned.
"My drivers?"
She gave a little shrug. "I thought you might like me to organize a Christmas gift for each of them." He seemed nonplussed.
"A Christmas gift? Well, Eric's been with me the longest. I usually buy him a bottle of brandy. I've done for the last 20 years, I think. Simon fills in on the odd occasion. He's teetotal, so I put a little extra in his last pay packet. I don't think it's anything you need to worry about."
Mrs. Sterling seemed oddly disappointed. "Well, I'd like to help. I'll buy the brandy," she said finally, clutching her bag in front of her.
"That's very thoughtful of you," he said.
She let her gaze wander across the office, then returned it to them. "Anyway, I imagine you must be terribly busy. As I said, I just thought I'd call in. Nice to see you, Her smile wavered. Moira was stung by the woman's casual dismissal. How many times had they met over the last 5 years? And she couldn't even be bothered to remember her name.
"Moira,"
Mr. Sterling prompted, when the silence became uncomfortable.
"Yes, Moira, of course. Nice to see you again."
"I'll be right back."
Mr. Sterling steered his wife to the door. Moira watched as they exchanged a few more remarks, and then, with a little wave of her gloved hand, she was gone. The secretary took a deep breath, trying not to mind. Mr. Sterling stood immobile as his wife left the building. Almost before she knew what she was doing, Moira walked out of the office and swiftly to her desk. She pulled a key from her pocket and opened the locked drawer, hunting through the various pieces of correspondence until she found it. She was back in Mr. Sterling's office before he was. He closed the door behind him, glancing through the glass wall as if he was half expecting his wife to come back. He seemed softened, a little more at ease.
"So," he said, sitting down, "you were mentioning the office party. You'd been planning something."
A small smile played about his lips. Her breath was tight in her chest. She had to swallow before she could speak normally.
"Actually, Mr. Sterling, there's something else."
He had pulled out a letter ready to sign.
"Righto, what is it?"
"This arrived 2 days ago."
She handed him the handwritten envelope.
"At the P.O. box you mentioned."
When he said nothing, she added,
"I've been keeping an eye on it, as you asked."
He stared at the envelope, then looked up at her, the colour draining from his face so rapidly that she thought he might pass out.
"Are you sure? This can't be right."
"But it..."
"You must have got the wrong number."
"I can assure you I got the right P.O. box. Number 13. I used Mrs. Sterling's name as you... suggested."
He ripped it open, then stooped forward over the desk as he read the few lines.
She stood on the other side, not wanting to appear curious, aware that the atmosphere in the room had become charged. She was already afraid of what she had done. When he looked up, he seemed to have aged several years. He cleared his throat, then screwed up the sheet of paper with one hand and threw it with some force into the bin beneath his desk. His expression was fierce.
"It must have been lost in the postal system. Nobody must know about this. Do you understand?"
She took a step backwards. "Yes, Mr. Sterling, of course."
"Close the P.O. box down."
"Now? I still have the audit report."
"This afternoon. Do whatever you need to do. Just close it down. Do you understand?"
"Yes, Mr. Sterling."
She tucked her file under her arm and let herself out of his office. She gathered up her handbag and coat and prepared to go to the post office. Jennifer had planned to go home. She was tired. The trip to the office had been fruitless, and it had begun to rain, sending pedestrians hurrying along the pavement, collars up and heads down. But standing on the steps of her husband's workplace, she had known she couldn't go back to that silent house. She stepped off the curb and hailed a cab, waving until she saw the yellow light swerve towards her. She climbed in, brushing raindrops from her red coat.
"Do you know a place called Alberta's?"
she said as the driver leant back towards the dividing window.
"Which part of London is it in?"
he said.
"I'm sorry, I have no idea. I thought you might know."
He frowned.
"There's an Alberto's Club in Mayfair. I can take you there, but I'm not sure it'll be open."
"Fine,"
she said, and settled back in the seat. It took only 15 minutes to get there. The taxi drew up, and the driver pointed across the road.
"That's the only Alberto's I know,"
he said.
"Not sure if it's your kind of place, Mum."
She wiped the window with her sleeve and peered out. Metal railings surrounded a basement entrance, the steps disappearing out of view. A weary sign bore the name, and two bedraggled yew trees stood in large pots at each side of the door.
"That's it."
"You think it's the right place?"
She managed to smile.
"Well, I'll soon find out."
She paid him, and was left standing in the thin rain on the pavement. The door was half open, propped by a dustbin. As she entered, she was bombarded by the smell of alcohol, stale cigarette smoke, sweat and perfume. She let her eyes adjust to the dim light. To her left, a cloakroom was empty and unattended, a beer bottle and a set of keys on its counter. She walked along the narrow hall and pushed open double doors to find herself in a huge, empty room, chairs stacked up on round tables in front of a small stage. Weaving in and out of them, an old woman dragged a vacuum cleaner, muttering to herself occasionally in apparent disapproval. A bar ran along one wall. Behind it, a woman was smoking and talking to a man stacking the illuminated shelves with bottles.
"How's up?" the woman said, catching sight of her. "Can I help you, love?"
Jennifer felt the woman's assessing gaze on her. It was not entirely friendly.
"Are you open?"
"Do we look open?"
She held her bag to her stomach, suddenly self-conscious.
"I'm sorry. I'll come back another time."
"Who do you want, lady?"
said the man, straightening up. He had dark, slicked-back hair, and the kind of pale, puffy skin that told of too much alcohol and too little fresh air. She stared at him, trying to work out if what she felt was a glimmer of recognition.
Have you seen me in here before?"
she asked. He looked mildly amused.
"Not if you say I haven't."
The woman cocked her head. "We have a very bad memory for faces in this place."
Jennifer walked a few steps towards the bar.
"Do you know someone called Felipe?"
"Who are you?"
the woman demanded.
It doesn't matter."
"Why do you want Felipe?"
Their faces had hardened.
"We have a mutual friend," she explained.
"Then your friend should have told you that Felipe would be a bit difficult to get hold of."
She bit her lip, wondering how much she could reasonably explain.
"It's not someone I'm in touch with very..."
"He's dead, lady."
"What?
Felipe. He's dead. The place is under new management. We've had all sorts down here saying he owed them this and that, and I might as well tell you that you'll get nothing from me.
I didn't come here for...
Unless you can show me Felipe's signature on an IOU, you're getting nothing.
Now, the woman was looking closely at her clothes, her jewellery, smirking, as if she had decided why Jennifer might be there.
His family gets his estate. What's left of it? That would include his wife, she said nastily.
I had nothing to do with Mr. Felipe personally. I'm sorry for your loss, Jennifer said primly.
As quickly as she could, she walked out of the club and back up the stairs into the grey daylight. Moira rummaged through the boxes of decorations until she had found what she wanted, then sorted and laid out what was within. She pinned two pieces of tinsel around each door. She sat at her desk for almost half an hour and restuck the paper chains that had come apart during the year, then taped them in garlands above the desks. To the wall, she pinned several pieces of string and hung on them the greetings cards that had been sent by commercial partners. Above the light fittings, she draped shimmering foil strings, making sure that they were not so close to the bulbs as to be a fire risk. Outside, the skies had darkened, the sodium lights coming on down the length of the street. Gradually, in much the same order that they always did, the staff of Acme Mineral and Mining's London office left the building. First, Phyllis and Elsie, the typist, who always left at 5 on the dot, even though they seemed to carry no such sense of rigorous punctuality when it came to clocking in. Then David Morton in accounts, and shortly after him, Stevens, who would retreat to the pub on the corner for several bracing shots of whisky before he made his way home. The rest left in small groups, wrapping themselves in scarves and coats, the men picking up theirs from the stands in the corner, a few waving goodbye to her as they passed Mr. Sterling's office. Felicity Harewood, in charge of the payroll, lived only one stop away from Moira in Streatham, but never once suggested they catch the same bus. When Felicity had first joined in May, Moira had thought it might be rather nice to have someone to chat to on the way home, a woman with whom she could exchange recipes or pass a few comments on the day's events in the fuggy confines of the 274. But Felicity left each evening without even a backward look. On the one occasion Moira and she had been on the same bus, she had kept her head stuck in a paperback novel for most of the journey, even though Moira was almost certain she knew that she was only two seats behind. Mr. Sterling left at 6:45. He had been distracted and impatient for most of the afternoon, telephoning the factory manager to berate him about sickness rates and cancelling a meeting he had arranged for 4. When she had returned from the post office, he had glanced at her, as if to confirm that she had done what he had asked, then returned to his work. Moira pulled the two spare desks to the edge of the room beside accounts. She spread them with festive tablecloths, and pinned some strands of tinsel to the edges. In 10 days' time, this would be the base for the buffet. In the meantime, it would be useful to have somewhere to put the gifts that arrived from suppliers, and the Christmas postbox through which the staff were supposed to send each other seasonal greetings. By almost 8 o'clock it was done. Moira surveyed the empty office, made glittering and festive through her efforts, smoothed her skirt, and allowed herself to picture the expressions of pleasure on people's faces when they walked back through the door in the morning. She wouldn't get paid for it, but it was the little gestures, the extras, that made all the difference. The other secretaries had little idea that a personal assistant's job was not just a matter of typing personal correspondence and making sure the filing was in order. It was a far greater role than that. It was about making sure that an office didn't just run smoothly, but that the people within it felt part of, well, a family. A Christmas postbox and some cheerful decorations were what ultimately tied an office together and made it a place one might look forward to coming to. The little Christmas tree she had set up in the corner looked nicer there. There was little point in having it at home. now that there was no one but her to see it. Here, it could be enjoyed by lots of people. And if someone happened to remark on the very pretty angel at the top, or the lovely baubles with the frosted crystals, she might tell them casually, as if it had just occurred to her, that those had been Mother's favourites. Moira put on her coat. She gathered up her belongings, tied her scarf, and placed her pen and pencil neatly on the desk ready for the morning. She went to Mr. Sterling's office, keys in hand, to lock the door. And then, with a glance at the door, she moved swiftly into the room and reached under his desk for the wastepaper bin. It took her only a moment to locate the handwritten letter. She barely hesitated before she picked it up and, after checking again through the glass to make sure that she was still alone, she smoothed out the creases on the desk and began to read. She stood very, very still. Then she read it again. The bell outside chimed 8. Startled by the sound, Moira left Mr. Sterling's office, placed his bin outside for the cleaners to empty, and locked the door. She put the letter at the bottom of her desk drawer, locked it, and dropped the key into her pocket. For once, the bus ride to Streatham seemed to take no time at all. Moira Parker had an awful lot to think about.
I appreciate what you said, but I hope that when you read this letter you realize the magnanimity of my remorse and regret both at how I treated you and the path which I chose to take. My relationship with M is doomed and always has been. I wish it hadn't taken me 3 years to realize that what began as a holiday romance should have remained just that.
Male to female, via letter. Chapter 7. They met every day, sitting outside sun-drenched cafes or heading into the scorched hills in her little Daimler to eat at places they picked without care or forethought. She told him about her upbringing in Hampshire and Eaton Place, the ponies, boarding school, the narrow, comfortable world that had comprised her life until her marriage. She told him how, even at 12, she had felt stifled, had known she would need a bigger canvas, and how she had never suspected that the wide stretches of the Riviera could contain a social circle just as strictured and monitored as the one she had left behind. She told him of a boy from the village with whom she had fallen in love at 15, and how, when he discovered the relationship, her father had taken her into an outbuilding and thrashed her with his braces. For falling in love. She had told the story lightly, and he tried to hide how disturbed he was by it. For falling in love with the wrong sort of boy. Oh, I suppose I was a bit of a handful. They told me I brought the whole family into disrepute. They said I had no moral compass, that if I didn't watch myself, no decent man would want to marry me. She laughed without humour. Of course, the fact that my father had a mistress for years was quite a different matter.
And then Lawrence came along.
She smiled at him slyly. Yes, wasn't I lucky? He talked to her in the way that people tell lifelong secrets to fellow passengers in railway carriages. An unburdened intimacy, resting on the unspoken understanding that they were unlikely to meet again. He told her about his 3-year tenure as the nation's Central Africa correspondent. How at first he had welcomed the chance to escape his failing marriage, but hadn't adopted the personal armoury necessary to cope with the atrocities he witnessed. Congo's steps to independence had meant the death of thousands. He had found himself spending night after night in Leopoldville's Foreign Correspondents Club, anaesthetising himself with whiskey, or worse, palm wine, until the combined horrors of what he had seen and a bout of yellow fever almost did for him.
"I had something of a breakdown," he said,
attempting to emulate her light tone, although no one is impolite enough to say so, of course.
"They blame the yellow fever and urge me not to go back."
"Poor Boot."
"Yes, poor me. Especially as it gave my ex-wife yet another good reason not to let me see my son."
"And there was I,
thinking it was that little matter of serial infidelity. She laid her hand on his. I'm sorry, I'm teasing. I don't mean to be trite.
Am I boring you?
On the contrary, it's not often that I spend time with a man who actually wants to talk to me. He didn't drink in her company, and no longer missed it. The challenge, she posed, was an adequate substitute for alcohol. And besides, he liked being in control of who he was when he was with her. Having spoken little since his last months in Africa, afraid of what he might reveal, the weaknesses he might expose, he now found he wanted to talk. He liked the way she watched him when he did, as if nothing he might say would change her fundamental opinion of him, as if nothing he confided would later be used in evidence against him. "What happens to former war correspondents when they become weary of trouble?" she asked.
"They're pensioned off to dark corners of the newsroom and bore everyone with tales of their glory days," he said. "Or they stay out in the field until they get killed."
"And which kind are you?"
"I don't know."
He lifted his eyes to hers.
"I haven't yet become weary of trouble."
He sank easily into the gentle rhythms of the Riviera, the long lunches, the time spent outdoors, the endless chatting with people of whom one had only limited acquaintance. He had taken to long walks in the early morning, when once he had been dead to the world, enjoying the sea air, the friendly greetings exchanged by people not bad-tempered with hangovers and lack of sleep. He felt at ease in a way he had not for many years. He fended off telegrams from Don, threatening dire consequences if he didn't file something useful soon.
"You didn't like the profile?" he had asked. "It was fine, but it ran in the business section last Tuesday, and accounts want to know why you're still filing expenses 4 days after you wrote it."
She took him to Monte Carlo, spinning the car around the vertiginous bends of the mountain roads, while he watched her slim, strong hands on the wheel, and imagined placing each finger reverently in his mouth. She took him to a casino, and made him feel like a god when he translated his few pounds into a sizable win at roulette. She ate mussels at a seafront cafe, plucking them delicately but ruthlessly from their shells, and he lost the power of speech. She had seeped into his consciousness so thoroughly, absorbing all lucid thought, that not only could he think of nothing else, but no longer cared to. In his hours alone, his mind wandered to a million possible outcomes, and he marvelled at how long it had been since he had felt so preoccupied by a woman. It was because she was that rare thing, genuinely unobtainable. He should have given up days ago, but his pulse quickened when another note was pushed under his door, wondering if he'd like to join her for drinks at the piazza, or perhaps a quick drive to Menton. What harm could it do? He was 30 and couldn't remember the last time he had loved so much. Why shouldn't he enjoy briefly the kind of gaiety that other people took for granted? It was all so far removed from his habitual life that it seemed unreal. It was on the Friday evening that he received the telegram telling him what he had half expected for days. His train home had been booked for tomorrow, and he was expected at the Nation's offices on Monday morning. When he read it, he experienced a